Good morning. This is the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Elaine Baumgartel. This morning, we're going to host a conversation about sexual harassment. Just what is sexual harassment under the law, and what kind of a cultural context does this behavior take place in? For example, how do you know the difference between a raunchy joke and behavior that a coworker might think of as sexual harassment? Or how do you know if behavior that you've witnessed at work that makes you feel uncomfortable qualifies as sexual harassment under the law? If you'd like to join the conversation, the number to call here in Albuquerque is 277-5866. You can also call toll-free 877-899-5866. And we can also take your comments via email. callinshow@KUNM.org is that address. Joining us to discuss this morning, we have Daniel Faber. He is an attorney specializing in employment and labor law. Also joining us in the studio, Feroza Jusawala. She is a professor of English at the University of New Mexico, and she has some plans to develop a course on sexual harassment in literature. Yes. Good morning. Yes. Thanks to you both for joining us this morning. Mm-hmm. I want to start with you, Daniel. You know, in my conversations with colleagues and friends in the context of some of the coverage of issues of sexual harassment, especially relating to the Republican presidential candidate, Herman Cain, some of the things that have come up in our conversations are where exactly is the line between behavior that may be uncomfortable or unwanted in the workplace and behavior that rises to the level of being called sexual harassment under the law? Can you set us up with the institutional definition and kind of explain where those lines are drawn?
Yeah, just because some behavior is inappropriate or offensive doesn't necessarily mean it's sexual harassment. Sexual harassment in the employment context has to be severe and pervasive. That's the term that the law uses. It can't be a one-time incident. It probably can't even be twice. It has to be something that continues. And the law is set up so that the employer has the opportunity and actually has a duty to try and correct the problem and solve the problem, end the problem. So someone who thinks that he's a victim, or he or she is a victim of sexual harassment, must report this to a supervisor. Can't just go out and find a lawyer and after one off-color joke in the workplace, can't go out and find a lawyer and sue. You can't do it that way. You have to report it to a supervisor. The employer then has to have the opportunity to try and correct the problem and make sure that it doesn't become severe and pervasive.
It's something that many of us are familiar with in the context of popular culture and in politics and in media coverage of issues like this. I've pulled a couple of clips from one from a new movie that's out this year and one from a pretty popular television show. Let's first take a listen to a clip from the movie Horrible Bosses. I just want to set this up very quickly. Jennifer Aniston plays a dentist who is a boss in her office, and she has an employee who is a man who she invites into her office to have a discussion. And the visual that you don't get by just hearing the audio is that she's wearing a lab coat, but she doesn't have a top on underneath the lab coat, and she's wearing some lingerie. So you can see that she's not wearing proper business attire under her lab coat. And let's go ahead and hear that clip first.
Come in.
Julia, you needed to see me.
Oh,
uh-oh. We have a seat, Dale?
Do I have to?
Please.
Sure. It's a little ridiculous, but...
Look, Dale, you know, I know that I like to fool around at work, right? And I might even, you know, I might even cross the line a bit. But the last thing that I want to do is make you uncomfortable. I mean, it's just not professional, you know? And I pride myself on being a professional. So from now on, what I would like you to do is just tell me, you know, when and if I cross the line. Okay?
Okay. Now.
What?
Well, now you're kind of crossing a line.
That's that first clip. I want to play the second clip too, and then we can come back to some of the issues that these clips, I think, expose. The second clip is from The Office. If you're familiar with the show, you know that the show explores all kinds of inappropriate behavior in the workplace, both on a professional level and in a context that would cause the term sexual harassment to be used. This is a conversation between the HR representative in the office, Toby, and the manager of the office, whose name is Michael, and he's pretty notorious on the show for behaving inappropriately almost all the time.
The full story is that Randall resigned because of sexual harassment. So corporate asked me to do a 5-minute review of the company's sexual harassment policy.
No, Toby, no.
It's really not a big deal,
Michael.
It is
a big deal. It's a big deal! What are we supposed to do? Scrutinize every little thing we say and do all day? I mean, come on.
And then corporate is going to send in a lawyer.
What?
Just to refresh you on our policy.
What? No. Okay, what is a lawyer going to come in and tell us to not send out hilarious emails or not tell jokes?
Maybe not some of them. Maybe not inappropriate ones.
There is no such thing as an appropriate joke. That's why it's a joke.
All right. I laugh. I mean, they're pretty funny shows, but they deal with this very serious issue. Ferosa, you had a comment that you wanted to make.
Well, I had about the first one almost immediately because it's very interesting. We always think of sexual harassment as coming from the man, but we have a woman here in a sexual harassing situation. So it's one thing that we have faced in our own department. But, you know, we have to come to terms with the fact that sexual harassers can be both male and female. And the second one has to do with, of course, policy. And we do have a policy at UNM where everyone is supposed to take an online training course about what is appropriate. But do we make sure that upper administration also takes that and that upper administration also follows the guidelines? Actually, this is a very interesting topic. I wanted to come at it mostly from the educational and the example setting and the theoretical point of view. But Elaine, it's very interesting that you asked me today, as presidential candidates are coming on campus. Every time UNM has a presidential search, this sexual harassment issue somehow seems to surface. Last time we had an issue with our current president, who had allegedly used a C word apparently on an African-American law school dean. And he explained it, and it's been on various websites and so on and so forth. And we underplayed it. We downplayed it. And the last 5 years and the issues that have come up across campus have said to us that perhaps we should not have downplayed it. And all of a sudden now, a silent shiver has gone across the campus, especially among women and female graduate students and various people with the name of one particular candidate coming in from the University of Colorado, Elizabeth Hoffman, who seems to have downplayed the rape of Katie Haneda, the football player who then left Colorado and came to UNM and actually played and finished out her academic career here. That also raises issues that perhaps Dan can talk to us about silencing. In the classes that I teach, I talk a theoretical position that's called silencing the subaltern, where the lower level marginalized person is silenced and does not get a chance to speak out. In the first clip, it was a male who's kind of silenced and you know, edgy and uncomfortable. And in the second clip, there are males who are refusing to be silenced. But most of the ways, it's women who are silenced, and people are afraid to speak out.
Well, I want to touch on this issue of gender.
That's a very, very interesting thing to come at sexual harassment.
Yeah, I want to touch on this issue of gender. I received some chapters from a new book, which I'll pull up the name of that book in just a moment, from one of the KUNM listeners who said, you know, here's some information that you might use during your show. And some of the statistics that were reported in this book, according to studies that have been done over decades and in various different communities of people, women are more often targets than men of sexual harassment. And the statistics, according to this author, 2 to 7 times the incidence of men. Sexual remarks and suggestive looks are very commonplace in the workplace. So you have this behavior that's very, very common, and that it affects 25% of women and 8% of men, according to these statistics. Daniel, can you talk a little bit about the way that gender plays into what you've seen in your work as an employment lawyer?
Well, the statistics that you just quoted certainly would be borne out in the kind of telephone calls that I get every day. And I want to point out that the overwhelming majority of phone calls that I get from people who believe they've been the victim of sexual harassment, what they experienced would not rise to the level of sexual harassment under the law. I'm not saying that in a more general term that it's not sexual harassment, but the law would not view it as such. But it's true that it's very rare that it's becoming less rare, but it's certainly more rare to have a male call and have him try and explain a situation that he believes to be sexual harassment as opposed to a female.
Well, and part of what they discuss in this book, and the author who contacted me is William Foote and his co-author Jane Goodman Della Hunty. This is their book that they sent me a few chapters from. One of the things they talk about is how the behavior is perceived differently based on the gender of what they say is the target of the behavior, and that there are differences in the way that people respond in a work situation based on gender, based on age, based on race, that there are all of these different factors that play into how behavior is even perceived to begin with. And so, Daniel, real quick before we leave this, I don't want to leave the law distinctions to let them fall away too quickly right now. The definition of sexual harassment and what does or does not qualify as sexual harassment under the law, can you talk about the differences between state law and federal law and what targets of sexual harassment may experience under those two sets of legal statutes?
Right. In New Mexico, the laws protect victims of sexual harassment, both the state laws and the federal law. The main difference that occurs is that under state law, a victim of sexual harassment can not only sue the employer, but can sue the individual harasser. Under federal law, the employee is restricted to only suing the employer and not the harasser for sexual harassment. Now, there may be some other laws that the victim can sue the harasser for, even under federal law, but not the law of sexual harassment. That is restricted to only suing the employer. There's a couple of other little distinctions, too. Under state law, a victim of sexual harassment can't get punitive damages, but under federal law, the victim can. So
in other words, you could, under state law, you could sue an individual who has, when their behavior rises to the level of sexual harassment under state law, but you couldn't sue them for money.
No, you could sue. You could.
Just not punitive.
Not punitive damages.
Got it. But
right.
But for your losses.
What we call compensatory damages, mm-hmm. which is damages for emotional distress, which would be the main issue in sexual harassment.
And then under federal law, you could sue your employer not only for those losses, but also for punitive damages.
Right, punitive damages, which are meant to punish the bad person mm-hmm. And make an example for other employers not to act this way.
Or the employer, punishing the employer for allowing behavior to continue.
Exactly, that's right.
But there's also a couple of things. There's also the issue of creating a hostile workplace.
Well, there's these different levels.
So there are these different levels. So there's not just – so it's not just the law that ought to be protecting us. There should be policies that should be protecting us. There should be handbook policies that should be protecting us. There should be departmental and university-wide policies that should be protecting. You know, you can't just create a hostile workplace environment for someone, male or female. And going back to the statistic that you looked at, Elaine, interestingly, I found this on the internet. 90% of straight men do not believe they can be sexually harassed. By 90% of women believe that they can. Which is very
striking gender difference.
It's a very striking gender
difference. We're talking about sexual harassment on the KUNM Collins Show. If you'd like to join the conversation, perhaps you have a question about the definition of sexual harassment under the law, or perhaps you have a comment about these larger cultural issues that we've started to talk about with respect to gender experience of behavior in the workplace, you can give us a call at 277-5866 here in Albuquerque. You can also call toll-free 877-899-5866. We can also take your comments via email to callinshow@kunm.com. We're going to take .org, excuse me. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back.
Support comes from Visit Denver, announcing Denver Mile High Holidays, featuring lighting displays, theater, dance, concerts, and other holiday events scheduled now through January. More information at milehighholidays.com.
Support comes from Saggio's, homemade real Italian pizza, calzones, pasta, salads, and desserts, serving Albuquerque and the UNM community since 1968. Saggio's encourages support of public radio KUNM on Cornell Southeast across from UNM and at saggios.com.
KUNM programming is supported by the law firm of Rothstein, Donatelli, Hughes, Dahlstrom, Schoenberg, and Bienvenue, with offices in Santa Fe, Albuquerque, and Phoenix since 1976. For information, rothsteinlaw.com.
This is the KUNM Collins Show. I'm Elaine Baumgartel. We're speaking with attorney Daniel Faber. He specializes in employment and labor law. We're also joined in the studio this morning by Feroza Jusawala. She is professor of English at the University of New Mexico, and we're talking about sexual harassment. And I want to touch on something that you've started, Feroza, the different ways in which sexual harassment are established in a workplace. Daniel, can you talk about quid pro quo, hostile work environment, and then also the aspect of sexual harassment that has an effect on decisions that are made that affect an individual in a workplace. I'm looking at the...
You're talking about gender stereotyping?
Perhaps.
Okay.
Go for it. I'll jump in there if I'm thinking of something different.
All of this actually falls under the legal umbrella of sex discrimination. Sexual harassment is not a whole separate entity under the law. It's all falls under sex discrimination. And gender stereotyping is an area that is prohibited under the same umbrella law. Now, you talked about quid pro quo and hostile work environment. Those are the two legal theories that have been accepted by the courts of sexual harassment. And quid pro quo, what that is where an employee gets less favorable treatment in the workplace, or it could go either way. All right. Less favorable treatment in the workplace because he or she refused to submit to the superior's sexual advances. That's quid pro quo. The other one, hostile work environment.
Meaning, like, if you don't sleep with me, I'm not going to give you a promotion.
That right? is the perfect example. So hostile work environment is when there is a general anti-gender environment in the workplace. Like, here's the example. You go, an employee goes into the boss's office, and the boss, all over his office, he's got pictures and calendars with naked women. And that's something that certainly could affect an employee, could offend the employee, and could make the employee
uncomfortable
and could affect that employee's productivity. and that is illegal as well.
Let's take a quick call here. Clifton in Albuquerque. Good morning, Clifton. You're on the air. Good morning, Clifton. Are you there? I guess we'll come.
Hopefully,
oh, there you are.
Points. Can you hear me?
Could you start again, Clifton? We missed the first part of your comment.
I'm sorry. I said good morning. Thank you for having me. And I want to make two quick conjoined points. One of them is you have not really addressed the idea that, as we know about rape, sexual harassment often has less to do with the sex and more to do about manifestation of dominance, one over the other. So in your flick where Jennifer Aniston had the power, she was displaying the dominance. And so there's an arc, of course, over our history, you know, having gone from matriarchal to patriarchal and now conceivably moving back toward a more balanced perspective so that we may indeed see more women with power and therefore in a position to abuse that power. And the second point ties in. The professor talked about how we should not only have laws but also policies to govern our behavior. So I'd like to point out that those are extrinsic motivators and ask you guys to talk about how we might create an environment where men and women would have greater empathy toward each other and therefore this need to manifest power over one another might dissipate. Thank you.
Thanks for your call, Clifton. Let's take one more call. Glenn in Jemez Springs. Good morning, Glenn. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thanks for the program. In church this last Sunday, Sandra, a Methodist minister, was giving us a dramatic presentation about Mary when she got pregnant with Jesus and how it was not by Joseph and Joseph's options, one of which could have been to have Mary stoned to death. And it really struck me that culture plays such a huge part when we address this issue or just sexuality. And then secondly, our family backgrounds. I remember in my own family, my mother talking about when she first went out to my dad's Kansas homestead farm and how my dad's younger brothers all responded to her. I think we men just need to take a look at ourselves and be responsible. Take responsibility, given, you know, all the testosterone that we have. So I guess those are my comments. Thank you.
Thanks, Glenn.
Thank you very much for both of those questions. And, Elaine, allow me to answer both of those because they fit in exactly with what I'm thinking about. You know, the sexual harassment issue, particularly the way it is affecting our politics right now, is very, very pervasive. And it's very, very pervasive because we're not doing anything about educating our students, educating our society, educating our culture about what is right and wrong. And I do realize that some of this, what is right and wrong, could be relative. However, we need to have some kind of understanding and some kind of agreements among ourselves about what does constitute sexual harassment, what counts as crossing across the line, and what doesn't. This is the reason why I've been wanting to develop this class, which I call Sexual Harassment in Literature, where I want to bring in work such as David Mamet's Oleana, new Caribbean young woman writer called Zadie Smith, who has a book called On Beauty about the harassment of a mixed-race student at an Ivy League school by a white faculty member, and then a very controversial book by a man called J.M. Coetzee called Disgrace. It caused so much furor in South Africa that Coetzee actually had to leave South Africa and move to Australia to live because he was positing the other point of view, which is that a woman could be a sexual harasser of a faculty member, and then that faculty member has to deal with the rape of his daughter by a black gang, and then how does he deal with that? And so that it's very touchy. And what the first caller said about the distinction between rape and sexual harassment is very important. And Foucault, we bring in Foucault when we talk about the theoretical issues, talked about power and dominance. And that's very important, and especially in the workplace, especially in the university, especially as we look at candidates, we need to look at issues of power and dominance. Who has the power? Who dominates over women? What kind of power does a faculty member have in a class? And if the faculty member has power in a class, then do the students give in because they're unable to stand against that particular power? And together with that is the issue of administrators, and do we want to bring in administrators who misuse power and thereby sweep under the carpet issues that could be affecting our students, our faculty, our freedom of speech? This is all very, very important, and it's time for us to start just speaking out. We are afraid to speak out because we are afraid to lose our jobs, but there are wonderful lawyers like Dan right here, and we need to start speaking out against those things that silence the subaltern.
There, I want to talk about this issue of power that you've expanded upon, Feroza, and I also want to touch on something that you mentioned. Dan, can you distinguish sex crimes from discrimination and the issue of a civil crime like sexual harassment, and how sometimes something that happens in a workplace might qualify as both types of crimes or neither, or one or the other?
Okay. Because of the power differential in the workplace, well, that's the reason that sexual harassment is illegal. Behavior that would be perfectly acceptable in a bar and not illegal, and nobody thinks it should be illegal. If that were to take place in the workplace because of the power differential between the employer and the employee or the supervisor and the employee, that becomes unlawful. The difference, and I think what you're talking about, Elaine, is that the severe and pervasive aspect of sexual harassment means it has to be something that occurs more than just a few times. It has to occur over a period of time. However, one instance of improper contact with another person, and this is whether it's in the workplace or not, could be sexual assault. So one instance of groping, even if it's in a bar, could be sexual assault, which is a crime and not a civil action.
Right.
Well, and actually, it could be a civil action as well.
So, and I think kind of what we're talking about here is this line about what is behavior that is appropriate, what is behavior that is appropriate or inappropriate in what context, and how does the issue of power play into it? Because, of course, I come back to this idea that power is played out in every social context, not just in the workplace. And Feroza, maybe this question of should there be some behavior that is not okay in a bar, even though it's not a work
solution.
And we're talking about like a client in a bar, not two employees in a bar.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There should be behavior that should not be acceptable in a bar, in a sports bar, anywhere else. And that's the education part of it that we need to do. We need to train our women to stand up and say, we're not going to be not going to put up with this kind of thing. But we also need to train our women not to be participants in this. You know, when we're talking about Herman Cain, we're talking about Herman Cain's wife, we're talking about Newt Gingrich, but what about the Ginger Whites and the Rael Hunters? What about a woman like Rael Hunter who allowed Jonathan Edwards to be involved in a relationship with her while his wife was sick with cancer? And what about a woman like Ginger White who is in a 13-year affair with a man and then comes out and says, well, maybe it was sexual harassment. And then somewhere on AOL, she has been saying, well, she needed the money and so forth. Then what's the line between conceding to that kind of behavior and prostitution?
Well, and let's pose this other question of, you know, I have certainly worked in environments where I had pretty playful relationships with people that I worked with, where there were jokes and it was fun and I was consenting and my coworkers were consenting and there was no violation from my perspective or that of my coworkers about the behavior. And I think that's part of this question, is that the line is going to be different for different people. And how can we make one line for everyone? I want to take a call, and then we can, you know, kind of continue with this. Let's take Carl in Albuquerque. Good morning, Carl. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you for addressing this very crucial topic of importance. I'm glad that you brought out the statistics that, you know, straight males has a 90% susceptibility of being harassed. So that means that I want to make sure I understand the statistic. It was 90% say that they were not in a position to be harassed.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. 90% do not believe that they can be sexually harassed.
I'm in the 10% that feels that males, straight males, can be harassed, not necessarily by women, because I am a straight male. I mean, there are some in the LGBT community that have positions of power. And my question was kind of alluding to that. Now, in the past, I worked in a situation where I had a supervisor, and, you know, he would touch me quite frequently, and I told him, you know, that I didn't appreciate that. So I wanted to pose that question to the lawyer, Attorney Faber. Would that be crossing the line as far as the possibility of having a, complaint about sexual harassment?
Is it any different for men targets than it is for women targets? Daniel.
There was a case about 10 years ago called OnCall, O-N-C-A-L-E, U.S. Supreme Court case, that ruled that it can be sexual harassment even if it's male on male and everybody's heterosexual. So that answers the question.
So sexual orientation, not an issue.
Not an issue.
Gender of the harasser related to gender of the target, not an issue. It's all about what the behavior is.
That's right.
Whether it's unwanted, whether it's sexual in nature, whether it takes place in this work environment and creates either the quid pro quo or the
hostile
work environment. You know, I'm thinking about the UNM sexual harassment training that all staff have to undergo. I, as a staff member at UNM.
On computer,
It's a slideshow that you go through on the computer, and then there are there's information that is presented, and then you're asked to answer questions at the end that confirm that you have worked with the material. And one of the things that I found very interesting in that training was that under the UNM sexual harassment policy, you could believe that you were being sexually harassed for behavior that took place in the room that you were in. You could be present for the behavior, even though the boss may be talking to somebody else in the room about a quid pro quo situation or some other type of behavior, but that you don't actually have to be the target of their sexual advances in order for that behavior to violate at least UNM's policies. Daniel, are those kinds of intricacies something that is state law or federal law, or are those the policies of individual institutions?
Well, what you're talking about is policy, but it is borne out in both state and federal law. The laws say that it's unlawful to discriminate against a person because of sex. That's the terminology that's used. So it doesn't have to be against someone in particular because of sex. It's just because of sex. So if someone else, if there's a bystander, can be a victim of harassment under that language.
Well, yeah, that's very interesting. Now, two or three things that you've already said.
Let me, real quick, Ferosa, let me give the numbers in case some people would like to call in, and then I'll come right back to you. 277-5866 is the number to call here in Albuquerque to participate in our conversation about sexual harassment. You can also call us toll-free, 877-899-5866, or you can send us an email to callinshow@kunm.org.
Yeah, so I just wanted to pick up, Elaine, on what you had said about playfulness. Now, playfulness in the workplace, does that become consenting adults? And, you know, that's a really touchy issue right now.
I mean, I'm talking about colleagues where I was on equal power level with them.
But, you know, but
wasn't my boss.
Yeah. But even if it's not your boss, even if it's just among a group of, say a faculty member thinks she's having fun with a bunch of students and they are, you know, just out there drinking or something like that, what happens with this playfulness? And, you know, that's interesting. A student just wrote into the journal about the comparison between the Penn State issue and what happened in our department. And Dr. Schmidley responded by saying, well, it's all between consenting adults, so it's not a problem. But there is a problem when you know, what happens with and among consenting adults. And then Dan raised a very interesting point, which is what happens with the bystander. Can the bystander claim harassment? And that, of course, just happened with the University of Utah professor who was on the plane watching child pornography, and his seatmate or somebody called the federal investigators. So, you know, but the answer to all of this is to try to educate people about what is appropriate, what is not appropriate. And it doesn't have to do with laws. It doesn't have to do with... It has to do with human decency. It has to do with human decency. It has to do with the way in which we should not be offending the other human being, restricting their freedom of speech to complain. I mean, you know, in one way, I'm saying behave with human decency, and people could say, well, then you're restricting their freedom to behave or their freedom of speech. But it has to do with being decent to each other, respecting each other's propriety, respecting each other's well-being. And that's the kind of education that we need to bring about. And we should not be silent when we see something that is wrong, because the more we keep silent, the worse it gets and more things happen.
This is the KUNM Call-In Show. We're going to take a quick break, and then when we come back, I have a couple more clips from one of the most well-known sexual harassment incidences or alleged incidences in at least my consciousness of U.S. history. This is the KUNM Call-In Show. We'll be right back after this break.
There's still time to get a tax deduction for 2011 by donating your unwanted car or truck to KUNM, because you get to deduct in the year you sign the title over. But it's best to call today, because you'll want to know the amount of the sale when you file. Tow trucks are ready to be dispatched to all parts of the state to tow away vehicles, running or not. You'll also get a KUNM membership for your donation. So get a 2011 tax deduction and KUNM membership by calling toll-free 888-KUNM-CAR.
So this is the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Elaine Baumgartel. We're speaking with Daniel Faber. He is an attorney who specializes in employment and labor law. We're also joined in the studio this morning by Feroza Jusawala. She is a professor of English at the University of New Mexico, and we're talking about sexual harassment. We're going to get to your calls in just a moment, but I pulled a couple of clips from the Senate Judiciary Committee hearings on the nomination and confirmation of Clarence Thomas to the U.S. Supreme Court in October of 1991. As you may remember, Anita Hill was a law professor at the University of Oklahoma at the time, and she came out with allegations of sexual harassment against Clarence Thomas at this time, and there were days and days and days of hearings that were broadcast on C-SPAN. And I pulled a couple clips from these hearings to explore, you know, kind of what was going on. This is, what are we, 20 years ago now. Would it be correct to say that it was this incident with Anita Hill and Clarence Thomas that brought the issue of sexual harassment into the mainstream consciousness of the United States?
In my opinion, that was the watershed event. Before that, I think very few people in the general public even had ever heard the words sexual harassment in the same context. So I think, yeah, that's the event that really brought it to the public's attention.
Now, you have mentioned to me, Daniel, that, of course, the law has changed over time with different precedents being set by different cases. But that at the time that these events occurred that Anita Hill talks about, it wasn't necessary for you to inform your employer about events in order for your employer to be held liable for sexual harassment that took place in the workplace. Is that the right way to categorize that?
That's pretty close. It was about, I think, 13 years ago, the Farragher and Ellerth cases that the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that there is going to be – that an employer will be able to take advantage of a defense to sexual harassment if the employee never reports it.
Right.
The theory is, and the logic is, and how can the employer solve the problem if he doesn't know about it?
Got it. All right. Let's go to these clips. Let's first hear from Anita Hill. In this segment, she is being questioned by then-Senator Joseph Biden, a Democrat from Delaware. Of course, he is now Vice President of the United States. Let's hear that clip.
Can you tell us how you felt at the time? Were you uncomfortable? Were you embarrassed? Did it not concern you? How did you feel about it?
The pressure to go out with him, I felt embarrassed about, because I had given him an explanation that I thought it was not good for me as an employee working directly for him to go out. I thought he didn't take seriously my decision to say no, and that he did not respect my having said no to him. The conversations about sex, I was much more embarrassed and humiliated by. The two combined really made me feel sort of helpless in a job situation, because I really wanted to do the work that I was doing. I enjoyed that work. But I felt that was being put in jeopardy by the other things that were going on in the office. And so I was really, really very troubled by it and distressed over it.
Can you tell the committee what was the most embarrassing of all the incidences that you have alleged?
I think the one that was the most embarrassing was his discussion of pornography involving these women with large breasts and engaged in variety of sex with different people or animals. That was the thing that embarrassed me the most and made me feel the most humiliated.
Daniel, granted, this was on C-SPAN. This was a Senate Judiciary Committee hearing regarding a U.S. Supreme Court nominee, but is this the kind of circumstances that people who are alleging sexual harassment may find themselves experiencing, and how does that affect people's choice to pursue lawsuits?
Yeah, that.
I mean, I don't know about you, but I squirm in my seat as I listen to her answering these questions.
Right. And that actually was a pretty good example of the kind of phone call that I get from people. They believe that they've been sexually harassed, and they describe a situation very similar to that. There was nothing unusual about that. And often, though, they never did report it to the supervisor because they're embarrassed themselves. And it takes, you know, a special kind of courage to even be able to take that kind of step.
Yeah. Fido, so you had a comment, and then I want to go to some calls.
Well, I have a bunch of comments, but, you know, it's very interesting to me that Clarence Thomas is sitting on the bench and the Supreme Court swept this under the carpet, especially after hearing this clip again. And my thing is that we should not be sweeping these kinds of things under the carpet. I just had somebody say to me that they were appointed to a Supreme Court committee, somebody who patently had used obscenities and been involved in obscene texting back and forth. And I'm saying to myself, who appoints these people to Supreme Court committees? I mean, you know, is there someone who should be watchdogging our watchdog court? And there again is the issue of human decency, you know, teaching people to behave appropriately with each other. This was a very interesting clip, and I'm glad you brought that up.
Let's take a call from Lisa in Albuquerque. Good morning, Lisa. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. Yeah, I think one type of sexual harassment that you haven't really touched on is the notion that you can have a person who is harassing, and as a consequence, people in the office are not given promotions or plum jobs or raises because the people who cooperate with the harasser, who put out for them, are getting that. And, you know, they're not complaining. They're not going to go in and make a stink because, you know, at this point in time, it's improving their situation, and maybe they like the relationship they have with that person. But for the other people in the office, what happens is they're stuck in a dead-end job. They don't dare leave. And since they're not willing to play the game with the boss, you know, they will continually not get any of the good jobs, promotions, raises that come through.
Mm-hmm. Well, I am not familiar with Anita Hill's writings after this, but it begs the question of whether people in circumstances like she experienced chose not to report those incidences in order to maintain a level of success in their careers. Let's take one more call, and then I'll come back to the panel. Kathy in Rio Rancho, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. I'd just like to make two comments. One, three. I am a former government employee, so I have been in the workplace in different situations. I would like to say that in order to live with yourself, and I am saying this to any woman or man who is in the line of fire for sexual harassment, you must just say no. This is not appropriate behavior for me, to me. And you tell that to the person at the very first second that you sense where this is going. And you must document it in writing. You have to have the dates, the times, the specifics, every time. If you do not write it down and keep an active log, you're really going to be floating in deep water. Thank you.
Daniel, your comments.
Well, I agree with that. The instances are much more provable if they're documented. And closely related to that is something that I think goes back to what you were mentioning just a minute ago, Elaine, and that's the willingness to testify. Sexual harassment is one of the hardest things to prove in court, and the main reason is because it's usually just the harasser's voice against the victim's voice. Often there are witnesses. That's right. Often there are witnesses, but they also are employees. And if you talk to them and try and get a sense of what they saw or what they remember or what they heard, they all of a sudden forgot because they're afraid for their own job.
And the retribution that could occur if they were to speak out about behavior they witnessed.
Which that retaliation is, of course, specifically prohibited under the law, but it does occur. Or I think more than that is that the employee is afraid that it's going to occur. Whether it actually will or not is another story.
Fotos, I want to ask you a question. How do you see this issue of willingness to report and the relationship with issues of power and inequality? When we think about the fact that women are most likely to experience sexual harassment, according to these statistics that we talked about earlier this hour, women are still paid, 70%, 70 cents on the dollar compared to men in the United States. How does, the economic circumstances or the perceptions of power that people have, how does that play into the circumstances that you are talking about when you call for women to take responsibility and to not be silent? Or men who've been victims. I want to include men in that question.
All these factors come into issue, Elaine, in terms of reporting. But I think the biggest fear that everyone has is that of silencing and is that of retribution. Again, coming back to the presidential search, we have a candidate coming in who fired Ward Churchill, everybody's afraid of speaking out. You know, so if you speak out, what happens to you? Even if you're a tenured faculty member and you speak out, do you still have your academic freedom of speech? And if you don't, you get quiet, you get complicit, and you go away with your tail between your legs, and you do not report. And that is a very important issue. And up to this point, really, until the point where you called me and asked me to be on this show, I would have been one of those people who would have been cowering under the sheets and would not have spoken out against injustices, either in searches and hirings. But, you know, it's time for us to get up and speak. The second caller raised the issue of a Methodist minister, and I actually brought a little biblical quote with me, which says, "We may well be perplexed at human fear and still more astounded at hatred, which lifts its hydra head, showing its horns in the many inventions of evil, but why should we stand aghast at nothingness?" And all this is nothingness. We should not stand aghast. We need to speak up when we see people who are not in the right, who are going to be our supervisors, who we need to speak out against. And I fully support the woman from Rio Rancho who said that right from the get-go, you have to say no.
Let's take a few more calls. Sarah in Albuquerque, good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. This is a timely call, as I've been working with this issue with a couple of clients. And, you know, one of the things that I have been struck by, having worked with women for most of my adult life, is where women actually perpetuate this, A, like you're saying, with their silence for themselves, but also this notion of how, you know, and this happens in schools. My daughter has undergone some sexual bullying by girls at a local Albuquerque high school. And what, you know, for me, I often wonder is where is this belief that she must have asked for it, she must have done something. There's a little bit of that belief in the matrix to where women don't often stand shoulder to shoulder with this issue. And Anita Hill has certainly suffered a lot of that kind of criticism, you know, and it is appalling that Justice Thomas is really in our Supreme Court. So those are my comments. Thank you very much for having this show.
I'd like to teach your daughter not to stand up to the bully. You know, I have spent my life being bullied, and I would say to you, do not. Please train your daughter to stand up to bullying. If it's coming from girls, if it's coming from boys, if it's coming from teachers, we cannot be bullied.
We have one more call, Ellen in Tijeras. Good morning, Ellen. You're on the air.
Good morning. I first experienced sexual harassment some 35 years ago when I was starting my career. And at the time, had somebody provided me with training as to appropriate response, it could very well have changed the whole course of my career. I think, and I've said this for years, and people have put me down saying, oh, women are victims, you know, they've got to be able to protect themselves. If they knew how to respond to some of the comments that are made.
What are some of the responses that know now? Give us a couple examples of what you're talking about.
The first time that I experienced this professionally, I was with coworkers of a higher status than I was.
Actually, Ellen, I need you to be real quick to your suggestion, and no, because we just don't have enough time to go into details about the context.
One suggestive remark after another. I'd never run into that. I didn't know how to respond. Years later, I realized that what I should have done at that point is said, gentlemen, I came here to work. When you're ready to work, I'll be back at my office. I would have walked out. I think women need to get together and have sessions in which they discuss how they could respond. And I think they could come up with some really, really good ones.
Thanks for your call, Ellen. Daniel, closing comments. Is that something that you think would be helpful to the people that you see in your work as an attorney?
Well, if an employee were to take the approach that was just suggested, there's probably a really good chance that the boss is going to see her as being insubordinate if she were to walk out. So that's going to be a risky way to do it. I think a better way to do it would be to submit her comments or her feelings in writing.
To the supervisor.
Right.
Yeah. Ferosa, very briefly, a last comment. We're just about done with the show.
My last comment is a plea across the community to people to look very carefully at the presidential candidates who are coming in.
You're talking about for the University of New Mexico.
To the presidential, please participate. Please look at those who are not appropriate for us. Please look at the whole pool right now very carefully. Thank you.
Ferosa Jusawala is a professor of English at the University of New Mexico. Daniel Faber is an attorney specializing in employment and labor law. This has been the KUNM Call-In Show. You can find information online at KUNM.org. You can also send us comments and tips for program topics to callinshow@kunm.org. I'm Elaine Baumgartel. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week at 8 o'clock Thursday morning for the Call-In Show.